From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, where are we heading in Iraq and what are the possible exit strategies? We talk with the Washington Post military correspondent Tom Ricks about the last 2 days of congressional testimony from General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker, what was said and what was left unsaid. And we'll compare their conclusions to other interpretations of the latest developments in Iraq. Ricks is the author of the bestseller Fiasco, about what went wrong during the occupation of Iraq. Also, critic at large John Powers tells us about the little-known war novels of English pilot Derek Robinson. Powers says he was instantly hooked. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. So, where are we headed now in Iraq, and what are the possible exit strategies? We've invited the Washington Post's military correspondent, Tom Ricks, to analyze the last 2 days of congressional testimony by General David Petraeus, the top American commander in Iraq, and Ryan Crocker, the American ambassador to Iraq. And we've asked Ricks to compare their conclusions with other interpretations of current developments in Iraq. Ricks has made several trips to Iraq and is the author of the best-selling book Fiasco, which examines how false conclusions were used to lead us into the war and how the occupation was mishandled. Fiasco has just come out in paperback. Tom Ricks, welcome back to Fresh Air. What are some of the major bullet points that you took away from the last 2 days of hearings?
I don't think we got the big policy divide that a lot of people expected, but I think we may have gotten something equally significant, which was a mood shift, a tone shift. No one is talking about Iraq as a success story anymore. No one is talking about it as someplace that's going to become a beacon of democracy that transformed the Middle East. What we got in these hearings on Monday and Tuesday was a description from Bush administration officials of Iraq as a place teetering on the edge of disaster, where we have very few options, and where we have to really cross our fingers and hope for the best. Essentially, they've thrown the war to the dissenters. General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker are both people who were very skeptical of the way this thing was conducted for the last few years. And now these people are saying, okay, you've given it to us. Let's see what we can do.
What did you find most interesting about the questions that members of Congress did or did not ask?
I thought the two hearings were distinctly different. The Monday hearing, which was a huge joint session of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the House Armed Services Committee, was kind of chaotic, sprawling, and circus-like, the first day of these much-anticipated hearings. The second day of hearings was much more focused. You had two Senate committees operating separately, so the senators had much more time to speak. Their questions were much more focused, and especially, I thought, the Senate focused on the issue of time much more than the House did. How long are we going to be in Iraq? And this was asked in a variety of ways by a number of senators, and it was really striking that Petraeus simply would not answer the question. He wasn't going to answer it. Partly, I think, because, as he said, he really has no good idea. Partly, I think, because he and Crocker came in determined not to make promises that they felt they couldn't keep. And they fault the U.S. officials who preceded them for making promises that, you know, that they couldn't keep, for writing checks that bounced. And I think they were coming in. They didn't want to have to come back in 6 months for the next scheduled assessment in March and have a lot of explanations about why their promises couldn't be kept. Instead, they simply wouldn't make them.
I'm sure you've probably read this article. The New York Times, to measure in an alternative way how things were going in Iraq, sent in a group of reporters to Iraq that visited 20 neighborhoods in Baghdad and surrounding areas and visited them repeatedly over time. And let me just read some of the things that were reported in this article. Iraq's mixed neighborhoods are sliding toward extinction, ethnically mixed, that is. During the troop increase, Shiite militias have continued to drive out Sunnis in at least seven neighborhoods of Baghdad. The Mahdi army, loyal to the radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, is turning into what many describe as a shadow government, while desperate Sunnis have come to rely almost exclusively on American troops for their protection. In Huria, am I pronouncing that correctly?
I think so.
There's been a Shiite takeover. The Sunni mosques there are empty, burned, and broken. And Sunni militants were driven out of Dora and into a place called Saidia, where they began attacking Shiites. So after Dora became peaceful, Saidia descended into chaos. So what the Times reports creates is a picture in which because of all this like ethnic fighting, some neighborhoods become safe because one ethnic group is driven out. So there's no more ethnic fighting there, but the ethnic group driven out goes into another neighborhood that descends into chaos.
I thought that was good reporting. It was a good article, and it really captured the feel of Baghdad today. One of the things that actually really struck me on my last visit there was just because a neighborhood is quiet doesn't mean it's good. Sometimes a neighborhood is quiet because it's been ethnically cleansed, and there are no longer contending militias. And that's what happened, I am told, in many neighborhoods where U.S. forces have gone in and successfully cleaned out Sunni extremist militias. Shiite extremist militias have simply fallen in behind them. And so you are seeing clearing and holding, which was the U.S. approach, but the holding is not being done by Iraqi security forces. It's being done by militias. And so in some ways, we're fighting on both sides of a civil war. In Anbar province, we have empowered the Sunni militias. In Baghdad, we have effectively empowered the Shiite militias as Baghdad increasingly becomes an ethnically cleansed city dominated by the Shiites. No, and it may be a prelude to a full-blown civil war.
Yet are we claiming these areas as success stories?
Yeah, because they look quiet at the moment. And this is something that really terrifies the Shiite government in Baghdad. Kind of our sense, their sense that we don't fully understand what we're doing. They're very worried about us cozying up with the Sunni militias, the Sunni tribes in Anbar province and now elsewhere. As one Iraqi politician said recently, baby crocodiles are cute, but you can't keep an adult crocodile in the house. And they're worried that what we're doing by allowing these militias to exist and actually giving them badges effectively is growing a lot of baby crocodiles as we head toward the door. And then after we've left, the Baghdad government's going to have to deal with them.
A related thing that you've written about is granting amnesty to insurgents so that we could work with them. You describe it as a variety of handshake agreements with Iraqi insurgents and militia groups, sometimes resulting in the release of fighters who were detained originally for attacking coalition forces. You describe this as a don't ask, don't tell pardon system.
Yeah, it's being presented as a great success story, and it is good to see former insurgents coming over to the American side. The question I've heard some people in the U.S. military ask is, are they shifting allegiance or are we? Are we simply changing our tune and saying people we used to declare enemies, people who were opposed to the government of Baghdad, we're now saying we don't care about that. As long as you won't fight us in your neighborhood, that's cool. The analogy might be the LAPD deciding on its own to go into South Central LA and hand out badges to the Crips without telling the mayor of Los Angeles and saying, oh yeah, South Central LA is quiet. The Crips are now the police force down there. And the mayor saying, what are you doing? That's what you have, the situation you really have in Iraq right now.
My guest is Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the book Fiasco, about how we got into Iraq and what happened after. And that's just come out in paperback. Let's get back to the hearings in the past couple of days with General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker. There have been questions raised about General Petraeus' independence or lack of independence from President Bush. You know, there's that now famous Move On ad that was headlined General Betrayus, in which he was described as cooking the books for the White House. Jon Stewart last night on The Daily Show showed General Petraeus saying the same things that President Bush had said, as if to show that Petraeus was repeating what Bush wanted said. What's your assessment of how independent General Petraeus is?
I have to say I was appalled by the Move On ad. I've known General Petraeus a long time, and I'll probably get criticized for denouncing the ad. I thought it was unfair and not accurate. I think General Petraeus is a good soldier in a very difficult position. It was striking to me that every time Republican politicians on the Hill tried to take advantage of the Move On ad by denouncing it, he ignored that. He simply was not going to wade into partisan waters for either party. I was struck this morning, I was looking at something else online that it had a headline, Petraeus, the Paris Hilton of generals. The attacks on his integrity, on his person, I don't think are really where the debate should be going right now. I don't think he's really carrying water for the White House as much as the White House has just tossed the whole thing to him and said, you do it, partly because he has the credibility. But to try to tear him down personally, it bothers me and it worries me. I don't think it's where the debate really should go. It's not the best way for this country to proceed. Iraq is a really horrible, terrible mess. And he senses that, I think, and is trying to present it in a nonpartisan way. And to attack him for that bothers me.
When you say that he has credibility, what are his accomplishments so far in the war in Iraq that gives him the credibility?
He's on his third tour in Iraq. The first tour was quite successful. He commanded the 101st Airborne Division during the invasion of Iraq and then in the first year of occupation up in northern Iraq. I remember being up in Mosul and being struck at how different his operation felt from other divisions. I wrote about this in Fiasco. The 101st really stood out for taking a very difficult situation. Mosul was a tinderbox because it had tens of thousands of Kurdish fighters and also a lot of former Ba'athist party members and Saddam Hussein loyalists. Remember, this is where Saddam's sons went to hide when they were on the run. And he kept Mosul quiet. He operated quite artfully, and he posited some rules that are enforced now nationally under him, such as don't do anything that creates more enemies than it stops. Another one of his rules was we are on a very short fuse here. We don't have a lot of time. Let's try to do things now rather than try to do things later, because eventually we'll be perceived as an occupation force. It would have been good had General Petraeus been able to apply those things nationally in the spring of 2004 rather than the spring of 2007. But it took 3 or 4 years for the Bush administration and top U.S. military officials to say, you know, what we're doing here isn't working. And effectively, they said, okay, General Petraeus, you're so smart, you do it. And it really was the dissidents who were given control of policy. Ambassador Crocker, for example, comes out of the State Department Arabist, who were kind of declared public enemies by the Bush administration early on. These were the people who so supposedly pursued the failed policies that led to 9/11. Suddenly, the Bush administration is listening to Arabists like Ambassador Crocker again. Ambassador Crocker invoked Beirut several times and the decline of Lebanon several times in the course of the hearings, calling on his background and the decades he has spent in the Middle East. So suddenly experts are in vogue again, an Arabist expert or, in General Petraeus, a counterinsurgency expert. These were the people who were swept aside by ideologues in the Bush administration early on. And so to attack these people, who I think are trying to talk about it in a mature and knowledgeable fashion, is really unproductive right now.
My guest is Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, about how the occupation of Iraq was mishandled. It's just come out in paperback. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Ricks, and he's military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, about how we got into the war in Iraq and what happened afterwards. And that book has just been published in paperback. What are General Petraeus' goals now?
What he is trying to do, and there's no real sign of it succeeding so far, is conduct military operations in such a way as to lead to political reconciliation in Iraq. That sounds very abstract, but to put it in concrete terms, a fighter for Muqtadir al-Sadr, the radical Shiite cleric, knows what he is fighting for. A soldier in the Iraqi army is better trained and better equipped, but lacks the core motivation that the militiaman has. He doesn't quite know what he's fighting for frequently. He doesn't even know if there's going to be an Iraqi government or really an Iraqi army a year from now. And so until you have the political situation straightened out, all that military strength is kind of a body without a brain. There's no central direction to it. What he is trying to do is figure out a way to get an Iraq stable enough for us to get out. And I would say probably in his heart of hearts, he knows it's a minority chance. But he's saying, effectively, what he and Crocker were saying in these hearings over the last couple of days was, look, we don't think this is great, but we don't see any better alternatives. If you guys do, speak up now. And I think that's why, essentially, they won these hearings, and then the Democrats lost them, to put it in partisan terms. The Democrats weren't able to mount a credible alternative. They kind of floundered around and said, okay, fine, see you in 6 months.
When President Bush announced the surge in January, he said that the goal was stability, political stability in Baghdad. And some people are saying, well, the emphasis has shifted. Now that there's more stability in places like Diyala province and the Anbar province, those are the places that the Bush administration is holding up as success stories. But these critics are also saying those places really have nothing to do with the surge. What's your take on that?
I think it's a pretty credible take. The shift in the tribes began well before the surge began. But as I said, the shift in the tribes, I think, needs a lot more examination because it's not clear quite who's shifting, whether the tribes are shifting or the United States is shifting. This whole bottom-up thing also, I think, has been inadequately examined. I'd hope the hearings would get more into that. There's a couple of problems with that.
What do you mean by bottom-up thing?
This is the notion of bottom-up reconciliation, which is how the Bush administration for the last several months has quietly been giving up on the Baghdad government. For years, we emphasized the central government, build the government in Baghdad, and then somehow it would seep out across the rest of the country and hold the country together. For the last couple of months, the Bush administration has talked a lot about local reconciliation at the village, town, and provincial levels, thinking that somehow it'll bubble up through the system and eventually lead to political reconciliation in Baghdad. The first problem with that is it's not clear how long that takes, but it probably is many years. The second problem with it is it might actually help tear the country apart. One suspicion I had of listening to the hearings over the last couple of days was that we are kind of tiptoeing towards a policy of breaking up Iraq. When you emphasize bottom-up reconciliation, you empower the local level. When you empower the local level, you undercut the central government, and there are strong pressures in Iraq towards breaking up the country, and these power at the local level might mean effectively just pushing it towards 3, 4, or even 5 or 6 chunks, a Sunni-dominated area, a Shiite-dominated area, and a Kurdish-dominated area with an ethnically cleansed Baghdad that's basically Shiite. You may get more than three parts, though, because there already is fighting in the south among three different Shiite factions, and they may wind up controlling different chunks of the south as well. So I think in these deals with the devil we're making, like a lot of things in Iraq, they look kind of appetizing in the short term, but may carry very difficult long-term consequences.
Well, there are some Democrats, including Joe Biden, who favor what they describe as a soft partition of Iraq. What is that?
Soft partition is, okay, we're not going to actually break up the country and sell it off for parts, but we will have powerful regional control and weaker central control. This is described as a kind of federalist approach. And I think that's kind of maybe what we may be backsliding toward. One of the comments you heard a lot out of Petraeus and Crocker over the last couple of days was Iraqi solutions for Iraqi problems. Now, on the one hand, that's very honest. It's saying, look, we're not smart enough or local enough to really know where this is going and to control the flow of it. On the other hand, it's a little bit of a smokescreen because it says, I can't tell you where things are going. Let's see. I was struck, for example, when General Petraeus was finally asked about events in the South, which I think are quite troubling. He put a very smiley face on it. And he said, oh, yeah, you have, you know, factional fighting down south, couple of provincial governors assassinated lately. But these are Iraqi solutions for Iraqi problems. Assassination and factional fighting, I'm not sure that's a solution. But he seemed to think it was, that essentially things in the south will sort themselves out.
Tom Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco about how the occupation of Iraq was mishandled. It's now out in paperback. Ricks will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Super Crunchers, Why Thinking by Numbers is the New Way to Be Smart, by Ian Ayers. More at supercrunchers.com. From TIAA Cref, putting the heart of a nonprofit to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. And from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, now available on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, four possible exit strategies, but no good solutions. We continue our conversation with Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post. And John Powers tells us about the war novels of British writer Derek Robinson, who flew in the Royal Air Force. Powers says Robinson's novels are addictive. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post. We've asked him to analyze the congressional testimony of General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker and to compare their reports with other evaluations of the situation in Iraq and other exit strategies. Ricks is the author of the bestseller Fiasco about how the occupation of Iraq was mishandled. It's just come out in paperback. The British recently withdrew a lot of their troops from Iraq and only have what you've described as a token presence left. What is the significance of the withdrawal and the way that they of its partial withdrawal and the way it happened?
Well, the first significance is that a key ally of the United States essentially is finished in Iraq. They are no longer having an effect on the South. The 5,500 troops they have remaining are on the outskirts of Basra and are not really relevant to where southern Iraq is going. Southern Iraq is now subject to fairly vicious infighting among three different Shiite factions. And this is not about sectarian divisions. They're all Shiite. It's certainly not about Al-Qaeda, which is not present down there. It's really about oil and the enormous oil revenues from the export business out of Basra. It's odd to look at the South and worrisome to look at the South. As one official said recently, if you want to know what Baghdad looks like next year, look at Basra now. And I say odd because the British and General Petraeus are presenting this as a solution. But it doesn't look like a solution for Iraqis. It just looks like a way for us to bug out and let the fighting continue.
It sounds like the British also withdrew a lot of their forces because they were under siege.
Yeah, and they still are. I've been told that the British are getting mortar or rocket fire on their base every night. And when they have pulled out of other areas, it has been under fire, that the bases have been looted almost immediately upon the departure, and they've been fired at as they move out. This is what they call transfer of security control to local forces. If that's the future for U.S. forces, I think it's going to be kind of very hard watching. And this really points toward something that Petraeus was hinting at without really talking about during the hearings. The key moment is going to be in the spring and the summer of next year, when U.S. forces necessarily start drawing down simply because there are no replacement forces for these surge forces. That means areas where the U.S. is now present in force are going to be turned over to Iraqi troops. And without Americans present, how will Iraqi troops behave? Will they behave like Shiite militias? Or will they act like an arm of the national government? Well, what if there isn't really a national government for them to be the arm of? What if they are really directed by Shiite factional sectarian leaders? So it's going to be really interesting to watch how 08 unfolds in the areas that American forces leave. And we're going to be pulling out those five surge brigades all next spring and summer. That's what Petraeus ratified. Supposedly, that's what the president is going to talk about in his address tomorrow night on national TV. And an Iraqi unit that has American advisors present might operate in a more even-handed way than the same unit without Americans around. So it's going to be really interesting to see how those Iraqi forces behave.
President Bush predicted that if we withdrew from Iraq, that Iran or Al-Qaeda would take over. Now, there have been skirmishes in the north of Iraq between Iraq and Iran. And Iran has been upping its rhetoric. And I wonder what you see keeping an eye on Iran about the possibilities there for conflict.
Two things. First, on terms of President Bush's rhetoric, one of the things that was striking and not much commented upon in the hearings was the departures in the rhetoric of Petraeus and Crocker from the White House line. John Stewart made fun of how Bush and Petraeus have used similar phrases. But what I think was more significant was what Petraeus and Crocker didn't say. They didn't cast Iraq as part of the larger war on terror. It was only when John McCain really pushed them and reminded them of the presidential rhetoric that they got in line with national policy. Nor did they say that if we leave, Iran and Al-Qaeda will take over, which is what the president has said. Rather, they said the country would essentially descend into a cauldron of chaos and fragments and factional fighting. They said those are the real drivers in Iraq, not these outside entities. That said, Petraeus especially brought up Iran a lot. He said one of the biggest shocks to him on his third tour in Iraq is the influence Iran is having. And I think they are very worried at how Iran is present not only in helping Shiite militias, but also inside the Iraqi government that we created and ostensibly are supposed to be cooperating with.
What role is Iran playing inside the Iraqi government that we helped create?
Well, especially you hear about the Ministry of Interior, which controls the police forces, the National Police, which the commission run by General Jones on Iraqi security focused on. The National Police essentially have been described as a giant government-supported Shiite death squad. And I would say that Iran probably has more influence over them than the United States does. Iran has been very effective in its operations in Iraq thus far. On the other hand, Iran has been hubristic in a way the United States has as well. It's funny, actually. Ambassador Crocker, in casting about for straws of hope, at one point in the hearings, said essentially that he hoped Iran would overplay its hand in Iraq. And that's kind of what we're counting on, that eventually they'll step on so many Iraqi toes that they will trigger the xenophobia that seems to be part of Iraqi culture and the Arab nationalism that's also very present in Iraq, and that eventually Iraqis who are currently cooperating with the Iranians would revert back to type and reject the Iranian ties.
Do you think that there's a possibility for more, like, armed conflict between Iran and Iraq?
In this part of the world, I think you can bet on violence and fighting, especially where Iraq is now. I mean, I'm kind of in a somber mood this morning coming out of these hearings. It's quite striking that the best argument that could be mounted for the U.S. staying in Iraq was not anything to do with democracy or liberation or ending terrorism in the Middle East. It was, hey, if we leave, you will have a humanitarian disaster of monumental and catastrophic proportions and perhaps in a regional war. And as Senator James Webb rightly pointed out, he said, hey, that's what the opponents of invasion were saying before you guys invaded. We were predicting this was going to happen. And so now the anti-war arguments of 2002, 2003 have become the last defense of the American presence in Iraq, which is quite sad.
Ramadan begins in a couple of days. What will you be watching for?
Every year that we've been there, the Muslim holy month of Ramadan has brought a sharp spike in violence. And much more than anything that was said at the hearings, I think a real test of the current U.S. approach will be whether we see another one of those spikes. The intriguing part of this is we've gone from late fall Ramadans, when the weather is much cooler, to a late summer Ramadan now for the first time, because it moves forward about 4 weeks in the calendar each year. So this is going to be a tougher Ramadan than the past. In Ramadan, observant Muslims don't eat or drink or smoke from sunup to sundown. And so the longer the day, the harder it is to make that observance, and the more tempers fray. I remember living in Kabul, Afghanistan, during a summer Ramadan, and it was striking to me just how many arguments you'd see breaking out among people in the street. Also, because you can't eat during the day, people stay up at night to eat, and so as the month progresses, they're tired, they're sleepless, and they're cranky. And so you can get a mixture of casual violence just from people being irritable, combined with an increase in Muslim consciousness, especially on a couple of nights in the month when people go into the mosque at night to observe key moments and then emerge from the mosque in the morning kind of fired up.
My guest is Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, about how the occupation of Iraq was mishandled. It's now out in paperback. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Ricks. He's the military correspondent for The Washington Post, an author of the bestseller Fiasco about everything that went wrong after the invasion of Iraq. And that book has just come out in paperback. According to the GAO report, the Iraqis have met only 3 of 18 congressionally mandated benchmarks. President Bush has evaluated the situation a little differently, a little more positively. Tom, do you have benchmarks that you're measuring the progress in Iraq with?
Yeah, I really think the only benchmark that really matters is Iraqi civilian deaths, with a parenthesis after it, Iraqi displacements, internal displacements or refugees leaving the country. That really tells you the bottom line situation. And Iraqi civilian deaths continue to be extraordinarily high. While UN ambitions, actually, as laid out by Petraeus and Crocker, are extraordinarily low, if you listen to them closely, really what they're saying is, we hope to get back to the level of violence of early 2005. Well, that is certainly not utopia. Early 2005, I remember in Iraq, was the Hobbesian state, the war of all against all. It was terrible. So they're not holding out anything particularly hopeful. It's a rather bleak vision. But that's what they're trying to say. That's where we're trying to get to.
You're saying that your benchmark is how many Iraqi civilians are dying. And I know you're also concerned about how many American soldiers are dying. And there's some deaths that
American soldiers dying is not a good indicator of progress or the lack of it, or success or the lack of it. If you want no American soldiers to die, all you need to do is pull them back onto the U.S. bases, which is where the U.S. military posture was in early 2005. They were on these big bases. They were isolated from the population. And it was striking to me how little they knew about what was happening in the streets of Baghdad when I went to visit them on these bases. Mm-hmm. A larger thing on benchmarks, as I was listening to the hearings over the last couple of days, I kept on thinking of a line from Groucho Marx, "Who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes?" The Bush administration presented the surge in terms of benchmarks and said, we're going to try to meet these benchmarks. When the benchmarks weren't met, they said, oh, don't pay attention to those stupid benchmarks. Again and again, the Bush administration has kind of laid down markers, and then when they weren't met, walked away from them, going back to, oh, there is no insurgency, and then it's just a few dead enders. And when we capture Saddam Hussein, it'll disappear. And then as they stand up, we will stand down. None of these things have been met, and they simply sort of move on to a new standard. And when the standard's not met, they say it was the wrong standard. You're so 2005 now, or 2006, if you're talking about benchmarks. Now it's bottom-up reconciliation. As a couple of senators pointed out, okay, 6 months from now, if bottom-up reconciliation doesn't pan out, you'll probably come out with some other new line about what we're trying to do out there. I was struck by that phrase, Iraqi solutions for Iraqi problems, which is probably a polite way of saying, let's stand back and groove on the rubble.
President Bush will probably hand over the war to his successor, and the next president will have to deal with it. Do you get the impression that the Bush administration is playing for time now, knowing that things won't are very unlikely to resolve before this presidency ends?
Very much so. This is really becoming the next president's war, and that was ratified by these hearings. The U.S. Congress heard Petraeus and Crocker present a plan for essentially staying in Iraq until 2010 and beyond. And while they questioned some of those impulses about timing, they never really mounted any attempt to present an alternative or to stop that. And so, yeah, what you saw was the Bush administration getting at least a yellow light, and I think really a green light, to proceed until January 2009, pretty much as they are now.
You know, we've been talking about Iraq and what happens next, what General Petraeus is saying, what President Bush is saying. Are there exit strategies that you've been hearing from alternate places that you think are interesting and have possibilities that America should be considering?
Well, there are four basic strategies available to us. And I was a bit surprised there wasn't more discussion of them in the 2 days of hearings, especially in the Senate hearings where the senators have longer times to raise questions. Basically, what you saw was ratification of stay the course. That's one strategy. A second one would be a total pullout. That was discussed in terms really raised by Petraeus and Crocker to denounce it and say it would lead to this humanitarian disaster. A third strategy would be soft partition, or partition breaking up the country in some form. There were hints of that, but it really wasn't pursued. And the fourth, which is something I think we ultimately may wind up with, and I think deserves more discussion, is falling back to some form of containment, not leaving the country altogether, but standing back, and as one soldier once said to me, letting them have the civil war they seem so much to want to have. None of these are particularly appealing strategies, and containment, the strategy I think we're going to wind up with, has huge problems attached to it. It's something that we really need to be very careful about endorsing because the downsides are enormous.
Wait, so you're talking about containment, standing back and letting them have the civil war that they seem to want to have. So containment will be just preventing that from spreading to other parts of the region?
Yeah, there was a good study recently by a new think tank, the Center for a New American Security, that essentially argued for this. And it's especially worth paying attention to because it kind of speaks for national security Democrats, I think, and so is likely to be the policy at least seriously considered by any Democratic administration in 2009. Essentially, it said, let's fall back, let's redeploy, get out of combat in Iraq, but not leave the country altogether. Let's pursue a negative strategy, not the quote-unquote positive goals of the Bush administration of liberation and democracy, but negative goals, and essentially three no's. What we want to do is have no genocide in Iraq, no safe havens for al-Qaeda, and no regional war. Now, that's far less ambitious than the Bush administration goals, but still a prescription for a pretty difficult and long presence in Iraq. How do you prevent genocide? How do you prevent the war from spreading across the region and spilling over across Iraq's borders? How do you prevent safe havens for al-Qaeda? All of those require a lot of American troops, a lot of American money, and are going to result in the deaths of American troops for many years. I mention it because it was hardly discussed at all in the hearings, but I think it is probably the policy that, ironically, we're going to wind up with in 2 years.
You've presented several pretty unappealing alternatives.
Yeah, I think this is why I thought Senator Obama's comments were particularly interesting, because he got to the bottom line pretty quickly. He said there are no good options left. And I think that's really where the debate should begin at this point. Any policy option you put in front of me, it's pretty easy to show that the downsides, the risk, are far greater than the potential benefits. But that's true of every single policy. There are no good solutions. There are only bad solutions. And what we need to do as a nation is discuss what is the least bad solution available.
Tom, when are you going back to Iraq?
Next month.
I hope to talk to you when you get back. And I really appreciate you talking with us today.
You're welcome. I always love coming on your show.
Tom Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, about how the occupation of Iraq was mishandled. It's now out in paperback. Coming up, our critic at large, John Powers, recommends the war novels of a British writer who flew in the Royal Air Force. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Our critic at large, John Powers, recently came across an English writer of novels about World War I and II that are popular in England. John was surprised that these books by Derek Robinson could show him so much about the experience of war.
A few months ago, I stumbled across a 1971 novel called Goshawk Squadron by Derek Robinson, which is about English pilots in World War I. Now, I've never been a war fiction nut, and what I know about flyers on the Western Front came largely from Snoopy's battles with the Red Baron. But I started the book and was instantly hooked. It was funny, exciting, and powerful. It captured the way that war devours young life. I passed the book on to friends, who in turn passed it on to their husbands and wives, and everyone loved it. And they kept asking, "Who is this Derek Robinson, and how come we've never heard of him?" The who is simple to answer. A 75-year-old Englishman, Robinson flew jets in the Royal Air Force, went to Cambridge, and worked as an advertising man. Eventually, he wound up writing books about rugby, cheery thrillers in the Ross Thomas vein, and best of all, hugely addictive novels about wartime aviators, with titles like Damned Good Show and A Good Clean Fight. I suspect the reason why his work is so little known here is that it's been caught in a no-man's land between genre fiction and so-called literary fiction. In fact, his best books, Goshawk Squadron and the epic Piece of Cake, make him the equal of celebrated British writers like Martin Amis and Julian Barnes. Robinson's war novels are set in different times and places, above the lines in World War I France, over bombing targets in Nazi Germany, aloft in the heat-dazzled North African sky. But the same story keeps unfolding. We meet a bunch of pilots, some brave, some stupid, some fearful, some mean, who fly and die violently. And they're replaced by more pilots who also fly and die violently. It sounds repetitive, but that's what happened. Entire squadrons would have to be replenished in a matter of weeks. All this would be unbearably grim, except for two things. First, Robinson is a thrillingly good descriptive writer who makes you feel what it's like to fly, to take off in a rickety bomber, engage in a dogfight, dodge neon-bright flak, or plunge helplessly toward terra firma. At the same time, he can make you laugh. His books contain some of the best comic scenes in contemporary fiction, and some of the funniest dialogue. Fending off death with wisecracks, his characters talk in a patois every bit as sharp as anything in Elmore Leonard. But unlike Leonard, Robinson's books don't feature indestructible heroes who invariably win. In fact, what's shocking about a novel like Piece of Cake, which ends with the Battle of Britain, is that it captures the cruel randomness of war. Robinson shows us that there were lots of ways for a pilot to die. Inexperience, bad equipment, pilot error, a more skillful foe, a bungling commander, or plain bad luck. Which means that nobody is ever safe. From moment to moment, page to page, his books never let you know in advance who's going to get killed. It could be the guy you think is the main character. Suddenly, radically, he's gone. Or it could be the raw recruit who you think is bound to last a few pages after being introduced. Kaboom, he's history. And Robinson never falls into the sentimental cliché of endowing his characters' deaths with some grand moral, intellectual, or patriotic meaning. You may recall that at the end of Saving Private Ryan, the dying Tom Hanks tells Matt Damon to earn this. Nothing remotely like that happens anywhere in Robinson. For all the pilot's courage, no overarching truth is ever revealed by any individual's death, except perhaps the darkest one. In the great machinery of war, the individual means nothing. Now, Robinson is not a pacifist, nor does he think that Britain was wrong to fight against Hitler. But without ever being cynical, his books brilliantly debunk the great myths of war that never seem to go away. He shows us that far from being the well-planned and well-organized activity we hear about in the media, they're always an unpredictable mess, what one British officer calls more and more cock-ups. More humanely, he also reminds us that we shouldn't fall into the civilian's comfortable belief that soldiers are heroes, a glamorizing cliché which lets us sugarcoat their actual flesh and blood sacrifice. Robinson's books are not new, and they focus on battles that took place decades ago, so you may wonder why I'm talking about him now. Well, our own country is involved in a conflict that's gone on longer than the one known as the Great War. And no matter how you may stand on the invasion of Iraq, Robinson will teach you things you probably don't know about what it actually means to fight in a war.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. If you want to catch up on interviews you've missed, you can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From Courgette Records, presenting Harry Shearer's new release, Songs Pointed and Pointless, original songs, original humor, in stores, online, and at harryshearer.com. And from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, now available on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After working together on the film A History of Violence, director David Cronenberg and actor Viggo Mortensen teamed up for the new film Eastern Promises. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with both of them. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.